Hello and welcome to episode number 53 of Light the Eye, presented by the U of I Credit Union. I'm Scott Beatty.
And I'm former high school tennis player Robert Rosenthal.
Yes, we have tennis on the mind. Wimbledon this week. So it affords us a chance to talk some tennis with Brad Dancer, the head coach of Illinois, and he has been the head coach for 21 seasons, and they just went to the Sweet 16 this last spring in May, and they hosted the NCAA regionals, first and second round. So it was a little bit tricky to, with everything going on, to get Brad Dancer here until now, and this is a good time with Wimbledon and tennis on the mind of everybody.
I am from a tennis family that was so much of a tennis family that my dad would make berries and cream for breakfast at Wimbledon on the Sunday morning. So get us up early, have berries and cream to watch, you know, Yvonne Lendl take on Boris Becker in the final of Wimbledon in the 80s.
I can remember breakfast at Wimbledon. And Dick Enberg, and like maybe Mary Carrillo, or I think later it was like Chrissy Evert, and those, and it was really compelling television.
And the names were so big in the 80s. I mean, from the early 80s of Borg, McEnroe, Connors to, I mean, look, I had a Stefan Edberg shirt at one point in my life. That's how deep I went with like my tennis fandom, because my dad was all about it, and we got, I believe, two magazines, Tennis Magazine and Tennis Monthly, I believe, delivered to the house, and I would read them cover to cover and update my own personal rankings. I was a tennis geek.
Well, I've been looking forward to having Brad Dancer here, because not only is he a good tennis coach, he's just an enjoyable conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
And there is actually a tennis football connection.
Isn't there always?
Yeah, we have to, you know, in the biz, they would say, let's localize this. But for you, it's footballize this, Illini footballize this, you know, to make it relevant to you. How does this impact me?
How does this impact Robert and his fire engine?
Yeah. Last week, Illinois football, as Brett Bielma would tweet out, got some good news for the family. There's a receiver out of Texas. He's a three-star wideout. Brody Knowles, out of Southlake, Texas, committed to the Illini, chose them over TCU and Arkansas and others. Well, his father is Mark Knowles, and some tennis connoisseurs would know him well. He was a former world number one in the doubles. He was a pretty good individual player, but he won three of the four Grand Slams in men's doubles. And he was also a five-time Olympian from the Bahamas. Apparently he's relocated to Texas. But anyway, so a former great tennis player. And we can't really ask Brad Dancer about this because it's...
Sure.
Coaches can't talk about even other sports.
Committed recruits.
Yeah, they can't talk about committed recruits once they're signed and announced.
But, sure.
But anyway, the tennis world's not that big, and so this tennis football connection's kind of cool.
And I was trying to think, the last Illinois football and tennis connection I can remember is he's no longer here, but Tyson Rooks, his dad was a tennis coach. Do you remember that video of, like, I think it was Barry Lunny played Rooks in a tennis match before Brad Dancer had an indoor match last winter?
And yes.
Tyson Rooks did take down. He has quite a big serve on him. So hopefully Brody Knowles is the same, and we can do Lunny versus Knowles in some kind of tennis match once he arrives on campus.
Before we get going, if you would, we would so appreciate you taking a moment to like, to subscribe, to follow, and if you could either give the thumbs up or give us a rating review, that just helps out the podcast more than any other way there is out there. So we really appreciate your loyalty on that if you have a moment. Thanks so much to our hosts here inside the Armory on the campus of the University of Illinois in the Center for Teaching and Innovation in Learning. I'm Scott Beatty, along with Robert Rosenthal. Our producer is Kendall Crawford, and our guest is Brad Dancer, right after we
light the eye.
Brad Dancer is here, Illinois men's tennis head coach. He just completed his 22nd season with Illinois tennis, his 21st as the head coach, and just passed up the anniversary of his hiring back in June of 2005. And he previously served as an associate assistant under Craig Tiley for 1 year. Under Brad Dancer, the Illini have won 3 Big Ten tournament titles, 2 regular season conference championships, and just advanced to the NCAA tournament this year for the 19th time. Under him, the Illini this year hosted the first and second rounds at the Atkins Tennis Center and advanced to the Sweet 16 before falling to stinking Ohio State. Brad Dancer, welcome and happy anniversary. June 28th was your anniversary, according to the bio, of being hired here. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
At some point, you know, our producer Kendall's from Champaign, and I have lived here actually since 2005. I actually moved after being a student back into town in 2005. At one point, do you like, yeah, this is, I'm from Champaign, Urbana. I'm a townie, whatever. Your kids are townies for sure.
Very definition of townie. It feels that way now. I think with Haley being from Mattoon and all of her, intermeshing of people and relationships and so forth, that Central Illinois, to me it's always a little more like Central Illinois, you know, just because so many people comes up, but it definitely feels like home.
I was thinking about you because I was traveling through Michigan the other day and saw the sign for the exit for Coldwater, your hometown, right?
That was where I was born.
Yeah, you went to Michigan State but ended up here at Illinois. So do you have do you still feel like I'm a Michigander at heart in some ways? Not necessarily with loyalty to any particular schools out there besides your alma mater.
No, it's interesting. If we have time, we'll go through that. Like, to me, you know, how you end up in your life is maybe a culmination of different things. And so I had my midlife crisis. I got my first car in 25 years. I've had a dealership car for 25 years, and then they tried to change that program. So I bought a car last year.
Okay.
And my midlife crisis was to put, if you've had sort of impactful moments, then you get a sticker on the car. So I put stickers on the car, and three of the stickers are sports stickers. So to me, that's the Tigers, and that was Mark the Bird Fidrich in sort of this mythological, bigger than life, you know, as a young kid, seeing that and just seeing all the people just gravitate to that. So that was a big sports thing. The Lions, because that's what we did on Sundays, is watch Lions football with my dad. And so that was kind of just always sentimental, that I'll always be a Lions fan. And then the Pistons with the Bad Boys. Mm-hmm. And just the transformation of like what it's like to go through the difficulties and finally triumph and then be dethroned. And just, I feel like that those are big sports things for me. And so I remain loyal to all those teams, Pistons, Lions, and Tigers, and those are my rooting interests. And then also as you think about like just big inspirational moments, you know, you were talking about Flack and Seguso earlier. Yes. So when we would go to Michigan State basketball games, I'm 9 years old, and they would take all the kids at Jenison, and they'd line them in a tunnel, and then the players would come out and high-five you on the way out of the court. So Special K, Magic Johnson, Terry Donnelly, all these guys that, you know, won the national championship that year. So sports, those are probably some just huge memories for me that maybe put you on a life path that you don't even realize you're on as you go through it. But, yeah, that's a little bit of my background. And I still have real strong feelings for those teams, support those teams. And then you know, the hard part is I've got two of my boys are Bears fans. Mm-hmm. So it's just not a good thing.
Well, you got to root for Ben Johnson, and now they get to root for Ben Johnson.
That's right.
Do you, when you took, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but when you took the job as the head coach, you're like, yeah, I'm here for 21 years at least, and this is where we're raising our kids. And, I mean, who knows where life goes, but here you are.
Well, that's the best part about it. You sign on here, and I think the 6 years before I came to Illinois, I'd lived in Colorado, California, Hawaii, Arizona. You know, I'd been all over the country. So I got here, and you get 30 days to decide whether you want to be in the state plan or the self-managed plan for retirement. And I'm like, no chance on the state plan, right? Like, I'll be out here in a couple of years. And that's probably one of the biggest mistakes of my life. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here with you. I'd be retired on a beach right now if I was on the state plan. So hopefully Josh will have me around here for another decade or so, because it looks like that's where we're headed.
But I put you in a group. I don't know. Are you in a group? There's only a handful now of head coaches at Illinois that weren't hired by Josh, but weren't even hired by the previous AD. They go back to Ron Gunther. So it's Mike Small, it's you, it's Renee Sloan for women's golf, and Dan Hartlib with baseball. Am I missing anybody? And do you get like some rank around the Bielefeld building with like, yeah, we're the OGs here?
Absolutely. I flex on Josh all the time.
So. Good.
Well, welcome to Light the Eye. We're really glad you're here. And congratulations, too, on this past season.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, you brought up I wish I would have waited to bring up Flack and Siguso, because I was so I was telling him beforehand that my, growing up in the Metro East, my dad was a huge tennis fan. He would take me to go play tennis at Cottonwood Tennis, Indoor Tennis Center, and they would be practicing. This is Ken Flack and Robert Siguso. They won, I think, an NCAA title at SIU Evertsville. They went on to be the doubles team of the early 80s and this and that. And what you're talking about with Mark Friedrich was this for me, of these guys are gods. In like, they walk by at the tennis center and I think I'm seeing Michael Jordan or whatever. So what were your first moments with tennis? Like, were you like, oh my gosh, give me Borg McEnroe, or give me, you know, what was it with tennis for you?
You better believe it. And for, you know, it's great because brothers and sisters and mom and dad all had different opinions, but I Borg was my guy, right? Yeah. And so I remember we went to, I can't remember what year it was, but my parents said, hey, we're going to take the family to the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. And so we got to go to the U.S. Open. And this is just funny. We got to see Borg play, but from the absolute nosebleeds. Sure. But some point down there, we snuck down and got to see him, you know, come through the tunnel, you know, whatever, 15 feet away from me. And like, that was a big moment for me to be that close to Bjorn Borg. And so you forget as athletes and coaches how impactful some of these things can be to young kids. And so that was it. It was my guy. And then when I worked in Colorado and left, the GM at the club gave me a nice parting gift, and it's a big poster of Borg, and it sits in my office to this day. And really? So what I love is a lot of people are like, is that you? And I'm like, yeah, I was that good looking, you know.
It's funny because people have that relationship with tennis. You know, people say, oh, I'm not much of a tennis guy, and then you bring up, okay, well, you know, they'll remember Jimmy Connors in the 1991 U.S. Open making his run to the semifinals and this and that.
Everybody, or McEnroe yelling at someone.
Yes,
or,
yeah. Everybody thinks they're not a tennis fan, but then they realize they have a very strong opinion on Jim Courier or Chang or Agassi or whatever. So what of all the, you know, sports in your family and this and that, what led you in the tennis path?
Yeah, really, I had an older brother and sister. They both played tennis. They both played college tennis at Eastern Michigan. So they were at the courts, and I just got, you know, parents dropped you off with brother and sister. It's just so different, right? Because they would drop us off at 9 in the morning, and we'd get picked up at 4 in the afternoon, and what are you going to do? And so at some point, you pick up a racket in your hand and start messing around. And man, those days seem to be gone. We've got a little bit of that with my kids. We do some things at the golf course where we just leave them for the day, and we'll leave them for the tennis courts, but mm-hmm. not like it used to be, where they were fending for themselves and mm-hmm. packed a lunch on their own. And so those are, I think, at least in my mind, really healthy moments. But mm-hmm. phones have changed that a little mm-hmm. bit, and I'm sure I'm to blame as a little bit of a helicopter parent as well, but try not to be.
Well, we parents have end up playing sort of the middlemen sometimes between kids and their friends, where it used to just be, hey, you know, be home by this time, and you kind of knew your boundaries, and whether or not you chose to honor those as a kid or not, but you knew who you could or couldn't, shouldn't hang out with. You knew where you could be or where you shouldn't be. And you were kind of given some freedom in that. And not that kids aren't necessarily, but, you know, like before kids get phones, like they don't just, they don't have a great way to like just go figure it out sometimes. Yeah.
And you got to make mistakes, right? I think you don't build confidence in yourself unless you make mistakes, get yourself in trouble, and then kind of get yourself out of trouble. And I think that we talk about that all the time. Parenting is, how can we do a better job of that? Because there just seems to be such a rest, you know, that there's a mistake made or something happens and we come in and rescue the situation. I don't know if that's helpful for long-term growth of my kiddos.
Does the same go for tennis players that you coach, where you have to figure out, maybe I don't say something here, let them figure out that they're in trouble and how to get out of it?
Well, it's a great question, right? And so, and that's one of the things that is probably the biggest challenge for me right now is you give me, if I know I've got 4 years with someone, then you see that timetable in your head. Okay, this is the time that they have to work through this. You can maybe mention a few things, but you know you want them to work through that. Nowadays, it's kind of a little bit, you're like, man, we've got 9 months to put this team together. And so I said last year, as one of the things I said in January, I looked at our assistants and I said, we are overcoaching right now. We're just, it's too much from us. And so, but that is the tendency right now, I feel like, with the immediacy of like what you have to do impact-wise. And so you got to find a balance of that, of trying to get all the information out there, all the psychoanalysis, all the, you know, mental training you want to do and the way you want them to think, and try not to overwhelm them and let them just still play. It's still a game.
Is the first instinct at this level when they come and you want to start coaching to work on swing mechanics, or is it all that other stuff you just mentioned in the head game?
Well, it's different for everyone, right? And that's probably the only thing I'm good at. I think it's identifying which areas to really attack on that. And they're all always intertwined, right? There's never, it's just technique or it's just tactics or something like that. All those things are intertwined and your mentality is always intertwined. So you're trying to figure that out and solve that puzzle and you want the best for these guys, but you also recognize it's, you know, you got a 10 deep team and you're trying to put the best six out there and you're trying to coach all those guys to get at their best. So that's the part I still enjoy a lot.
Well, I don't know if you realize this, but you were seated across the table from the worst tennis player to ever make the state tournament in Illinois. This is a true story. So I'm going to take you back through my tennis career. My junior year of high school was the last year that tennis teams in Illinois qualified by team and individual. They changed it in 91, and I didn't go to the state tournament in 91. But the top two teams at each sectional would go on to state, plus the top four finishers in each doubles and singles would go on to state. So I was third doubles on my high school team, okay? So if we played singles, I was sixth singles, okay? I was in the Southern Illinois sectional, which is by far the worst sectional in Illinois. Let's just say it. All those Chicago kids, their parents have been playing for lessons since they were 4 years old. These kids, these hicks from down south, weren't very good at tennis. So I was the worst player on the second place team, the second team to qualify. We made it to state. We lost 6-0, 6-0 in the first round to Homewood Flossmoor. But I do get to say I played at state. There's a picture of me on the wall of the gym at my high school of all the state teams. Get a photo on the wall. I am by far the worst athlete on the entire wall. However, I did play in the state tournament. So if you're wondering about the tennis, if our resumes are good enough, I didn't win a game. Well, no, I guess we won a set in the consolation. I mean, you know, loop back around. But we were not prepared for how good. It's funny how tennis seems to follow, like, I mean, obviously every sport is like this. And if some kid is dad starts him pitching when he's, 5 years old and he gets lessons and he's got a big jump once high school starts and this and that. But tennis has always seemed to be that, like, you've got to get the athletes early or they're going to find other sports. So do you find that if you're finding a kid, yeah, he's been focused on tennis since a young age and not like the best athlete in his high school who plays several sports, that type of thing?
For the most part, I think the in the U.S., the only time we get the great athletes is maybe if they've been on team sports and they just have that, they've got that gut in them that says, I want it to come down to me, you know, and I don't want my buddy dropping a pop fly or missing a free throw at the end of the game or something like that. And sure. if it's going to come down to me. And so those are probably the guys we get. And unfortunately, we're getting less and less of those in the U.S. I think because parents are putting kids into tennis at an earlier age, they're not getting a well-rounded, you know, athletic background behind them. So what we're seeing, I feel like at the moment is, kids that can just punish the ball, right? Technically, they're really sound. They hit the snot out of the ball, but maybe not able to scramble and play a ball and overhead above their head the way that you'd maybe think somebody could really do that. And so maybe slightly less athletic over the last 10 years than maybe the 20 years before that. But internationally, I still think some of the great athletes are getting involved in tennis. A lot of the federations have talent ID programs that are out there stealing kids off the soccer field and so forth. And so that's just a side note, but that's one of my things. And having the World Cup on is, you know, you watch sports on TV and it always slows it down, right? It looks very, you know, you watch the NBA, you can tell how fast these guys are if you've ever been to a game up close, and it looks normal on TV. These World Cup soccer players look lightning fast to me on TV. I'm like, I can't imagine what it's like, you know, in up close in person, just how fast-paced this game is. But sorry for that.
No, that's fine. I'm just curious. Like, before we started recording, you were talking about going to a Reds game and seeing Ellie De La Cruz. Do you watch other athletes and say, man, if he was playing tennis, an athlete like this with length like that, oh, my gosh.
All the time.
Yeah?
Yeah. And the tricky thing with tennis is the levers, right? Levers help a lot, but it's almost impossible after you've hit puberty to figure out how to control those levers. So I don't think you could take an Ellie De La Cruz and take him at 14 years old, and he probably could never learn how to hit a tennis ball properly. It just seems like
a baby giraffe.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yeah. And again, that's me surmising a whole bunch of things, but I don't see that happening. I've seen it before. We take great athletes off the football field to do something, you know, over at Atkins, and it's just, you know, they can jump up and touch the ceiling or run over there, but just that coordinated aspect of controlling that lever is tricky.
Yeah.
So recently, basketball here at the U of I, Brad Underwood has gone to a bunch of guys with the last name that ends in IC and are an itch. And are you ever like to Brad, hey, hold my beer with the recruiting you've done from Eastern Europe, but actually across Europe?
Yeah. I think for us, you know, it's interesting. If you look at two of our former players that are doing really well right now, Alex Vukic and Alex Kovacevic, you know, both Serbian descent, and so they kind of fit right in that Balkan landscape. And, you know, I think there's the reality of it is, you know, the circumstances we live in the U.S. and so forth are different than they are in the rest of the world. And so when people see that opportunity and they're hungry for that opportunity, it's a great combination, and it's such a tricky balance, right? Because you've got a lot of people that feel like some domestic student athletes are missing out on opportunities. You know, they're being taken by this, and that there's a fact to that they are. There are probably less opportunities now for American kids in collegiate sports, and so my opinion on that and my feel on that is, it's tough. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and you've got to be one of the best to earn spots at these places.
But one of the things you're charged with is to put together the best team you can and go win. And I'm not here to suggest you should be building or any coach should be building a roster differently, but if you do have that feel of, like, I've got to get American kids on, you know, at what point you just go, it doesn't matter. I have to get the best roster I can get because this is big boy, big girl sports.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And again, I think Brad would say the same thing, right? You're trying. And again, at the same token, you teams still have to mesh, right? Mm-hmm. Chemistry is still important. Culture is still important. And so, what they were able to do last year was really, I don't want to say shocking, because there's a lot of talent out there on that basketball floor, but the fact that Brad's been able to put these guys and they gelled so closely together, right, and they seem to mesh so well, I think is a testament. That doesn't happen like that. It doesn't happen automatically, so I know Brad and his staff deserve a ton of credit for that.
But tennis at the collegiate level is a bit similar, I would say, to golf, where it's a collection of individuals. You got your doubles, but do you, in your most successful seasons, do you look back and say, yeah, we meshed really well? Do you need them to mesh in the same way that you have to have a football team or a basketball team mesh? Because, hey, one has to go beat the other one, two has to go beat the two, and three has to, and that's it. Like,
it's interesting you say that. It just doesn't seem like it would be important, and for some reason it's still so important, and it matters to the team, and it's just a, I think there's those moments in competition where you got to dig to that certain level or it's not going to happen. And particularly, I always talk about that, like just road conference matches. You know, if you ask Brett and Brad, you know, I text them every time they win on the road, even if they're favorites, I'm just like, congrats, because just road conference wins just are never easy to come by. And so those are the places where I feel like you just got to dig deep and really kind of have that brotherhood.
You know, I watched a podcast, a tennis podcast, they were doing an episode on, they did a whole segment on you recruiting Gabriel DeBrew and Ohio State recruiting Victor Liloff, as they were basically an international tennis kind of podcast, saying like, this is new. Like, these players, somebody who won the French Open junior, I think Liloff was like the number three junior in the world at the time or whatever. These players would stay in Europe and this and that. Now they're coming to play college tennis at Ohio State and Illinois. I'm assuming that NIL is part of this, but what they were like, it was a big like, hey, this is a shift here. These are kids that are, I'm not going to go the college path. I'm going straight to play this and play that event and, you know, start working on my points and this and that. So what it, explain to me the shift, as I know you had DeBrew's brother here and that was a kind of a natural fit, but explain to me the shift that they were talking about there.
I think it's three things. Number one, you've got these incredible players playing late into the 30s, right? So you get the Djokovic's, the Fed, Nadal, who are playing late into the 30s when Borg retired at 27 years old.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's the first thing, right? Is like my career, it's not a 8-year window, 9-year window, like I think some players used to think. Number two, there's been just, you know, somewhat consistently over 30 years, guys coming out of college and making that jump. And so it's become more and more and more over the last few years. And then the final frontier, as you alluded to, is NIL. So now you have a situation where a young man could potentially, you know, where he's, those first few years on tour until you get in the top 100 are really rough financially. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. You're saying not only are you free coaching, free travel, free equipment, free everything else, but I've got a chance to maybe put some cash in my pocket to help kickstart my career at the end of the day. And so that's, to me, the three facets that have really changed that and why you're seeing more prolific players coming into the collegiate ranks.
Yeah, and at the same time as that, we've seen schools cutting tennis lately, you know, like SLU and St. Louis and everything else of like, this. And, you know, I've read some things on it where people were saying like, yeah, because there's so much international recruiting now, it's just a really difficult program to justify financially kind of thing. Do you think that's what's going on, or what are your views on that?
It's tough to say. And again, every time a program gets cut, your heart goes out to, you know, the coaches, the people involved, the university, and you wish there was something, you know, maybe if you would have known about it, hey, we would have taken this step, or we would have played, scheduled that team, or, you know, you're always trying to think, what role could I have played to maybe prevent that? And, you know, I think from the research that we've done, and the ITA has done a great job of kind of talking to athletic directors about this, it's not one reason or another that programs are getting cut. It's a myriad of situations, and it's almost always unique to that community and to that athletic department. And so we don't want to see, and I don't want to see a cross country program or a golf or any program getting cut, because you're taking away opportunities from young kids, and you know they've got that initiative now where it's only 4 in 10 kids are playing sports or something like that Scott Van Pelt's been really involved in. And so those are things for me. I think sports can add a lot to children's lives. So anytime any program gets cut, whether it's tennis or anything else, it's a little bit disappointing.
Yeah.
We're recording this ahead of time, but as this is coming out, it's Wimbledon week. You have gone on many occasions. Will you be there?
I'm not going to be there. We just then decided that in the last few hours, not a few hours, but in the last few days here. I was going to go over and spend some time with Alex Vukic, but I think we've got someone that can take my spot for that and get him through.
Oh,
there.
That's kind of you to offer.
But it's a Wimbledon is, I don't know, to me it's a special one. There's just something about the grass, playing on grass, what center court feels like, It's a different. All the Grand Slams are fantastic. All the tournaments are fantastic. We were talking about Mason earlier and so forth, but Wimbledon is the crown jewel in my mind.
Yeah, and I remember when Kevin Anderson made his run in Wimbledon a few years ago. You know, you were there for that, and I'm curious what the college coach relationship is once they become pro, and especially it seems like there's been a number of times like I want him there. You know, I got, you know, are you, because every guy gets his or gal gets their coach, right? They all have these individual coaches, but what's the former college coach do for the folks that are now in the pro ranks?
Yeah, I have different relationships with different former players, and so some of them you know, talk a couple times a week still, and then others, you know, they kind of spread their wings and go and so forth. But for the most part, the guys that keep playing, we stay in regular contact with, you know, me or one of the other staff, and really just support them and talk through all the things, the wins, the losses, the scheduling. Scheduling is a big part of it, right? Like just trying to navigate where their head's at and what's the next tournament and sequence of tournaments and so forth. So, but yeah, it's a big part of it for me is you coach for the relationships, and you coach, you know, those relationships don't stop when they finish here.
What is that world of, I mean, maybe you're coaching them, maybe you're just offering advice wherever, but I guess that whole world of individual coaches for professional players versus the college coach, the team coaching, you know, what's the difference there and what you're trying to do?
Well, it's so fun. I went and spent a couple of weeks last summer with Vukic, and what you get to do when you're coaching one player is you get to get into such tiny minutiae, right? And these little tiny details, and oh, if this happens or that happens, and you're talking about really, really finite aspects that are, as a coach, are fun, right? To get into that, like, man, we don't, when you got six matches going at the same time, it's like, hey, survive these 3 points, I'll be back to come talk to you. And so it's not quite as finite, and so that's really enjoyable to me, to get your brain thinking at that level of I think just for professionalism, if you will. But that's probably the biggest difference. And but I love managing the team too, like it's just different animals.
Yeah. Rajiv Ram, is he in Wimbledon this year? Yeah. I know he was at the French, so he is, I don't know how to say this, still going. I mean, like, it's like Rajiv Ram, here's another major, here we go, another doubles.
I think for him, you know, you talk to him 8 years ago and he's talking about slowing down and what he's going to, and then he goes and wins, you know, and it's 7 years ago, I'll probably slow down here, and then he goes and wins, and he just keeps winning. Every time I think he thinks about slowing down, you know, he goes and wins another tournament.
He must be on one of those self-managed retirement plans.
Yeah, exactly.
How many Grand Slam doubles titles does he have? Three?
I think so, right? He and Joe won U.S. twice, I want to say, mm-hmm. And then he's got a mixed in there. Maybe four, maybe two. Okay. Two, yeah. Raj will kill me for not knowing that off the top of my head.
Why do you think, again, all of my memories here are probably influenced by Ken Flack and Robert Seguso, but, like, I remember watching the doubles final every year with my dad, and now you just can't see that. Why do you think doubles and mixed has just fallen down to, like, you know, Saturday's women's singles, Sunday's men's singles, and move on to the next tournament?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer to that. I think the reason the doubles players are not complaining about it is the prize money keeps going up, sure, so their sure. pockets are getting lined. But yeah. There's no question. The exposure's not there. The media attention's not there. The ATP, I don't know, I can't say about WTA, but the ATP, I think, is put their guns out in terms of, these are the guys we're promoting, this is what we're doing, and yeah. and that's it's working for them. I think the tour is really healthy at the moment, but that's a great question. Yeah, mm-hmm. It does seem to be like, to just, you don't see the coverage anymore. And I think when the Bryan brothers retired, that was also another, sure. just yeah. you know, who's, there's no obvious American team or something like that to take over the throne.
Yeah, and also Davis Cup is kind of like, again, growing up with a dad who was obsessed with tennis. Like, we didn't miss Davis Cup if it was somewhere on cable or whatever, and now that just doesn't seem to be.
They've you know, you flirt around and try format changes, and you try to see what's going to work, and yep. I don't know, it's one of those things where the ties early in the year are a big deal to the host country mm-hmm. to be able to host those ties and grow tennis in their sport, and so I think there's incredible value to that. We have to recognize that, but from a global stance and like getting the public behind it and following the big names, it's not there. There's no clarity on the calendar of how that works. I'm in tennis and I can't exactly tell you how the Davis Cup calendar works. Yeah. And so that'll go to show you just, it's really confusing for the public and so forth. And so I think, you know, I always say that would be an area for an intelligent dictator to come in and take over and say like, this is how we're going to do it. And
Maybe Craig's that guy.
Yeah. I haven't met an intelligent dictator yet. Though. That's the problem. A couple of items that have come up recently. Last week, we learned that you're going to be hosting the ITA kickoff weekend in January of 2027. You're hosting Stanford, Cornell, and Ole Miss at the Atkins Tennis Center. What is the significance of getting that event in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, it was one of our big goals this year is to make sure we finish in the top 14. Those are the schools that host. And so really proud of the guys for, you know, just again, any bad loss along the year kind of knocks that out of you. So you got to be really consistent throughout the year to finish in those spots. And what it does is it gives you some momentum going into the next year because you're starting off the year and you're hosting three great teams. And at least you get those, you know, last couple of years we've been on the road. We haven't gotten out of it. We haven't made it indoors in a couple of years now. And that used to seem like a birthright for Illinois tennis to be playing at the indoor championships. So for us, it's an advantage to host. We have some great teams coming in. We recognize that. But, now it's my job to have the team ready for that.
You announced a transfer coming last week. Colson Wells, not Corson. Colson.
Orson Welles.
Yeah, the great actor.
Yes.
Son. No, Colson Wells is transferring from Nebraska. So I don't know. Some Nebraska fan might say you stole him, but that's the way of the world these days. And he is from Okemos, not too far away from your neck of the woods when you're growing up. He's from Okemos, Michigan.
Yeah. Colson, I was a big fan in the recruiting process the first time around, and I think that was just coming in with roster limits and so forth, and we're just trying to figure out how to manage that. We just didn't have a spot for him at that time, and we followed him at Nebraska and have a lot of respect. He's had a little bit of injury issues over his time there, but I think he's 100% healthy now. And we're just talked to him a couple hours ago, trying to get him down here, get cleared by our docs, and I can't wait to get started working with him. I think he's got a ton of opportunity in front of us there.
As we're talking, if you can say, we don't know all the names, but is your roster kind of set for 26-27?
I wish, right? Yeah. So we've got some work to do. Coach Kopinski is landed in Europe this morning, and so we're on the hot trail, and I'm spending a lot of hours every day, making calls around the world and seeing who might be the next best fit here at Illinois.
So he gets to go to Europe. I mean, I kind of wouldn't mind that gig.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yes.
Send me to Wimbledon if you don't want to go.
That's right.
Send me to the shores of the Mediterranean.
There you go.
Or wherever it is he's going.
Yeah.
The other thing, and you were so complimentary. I heard you in interviews when Evan Clark's retired from head coach women. The new women's tennis head coach has been announced, Elizabeth Lumpkin Robinson, who comes from Naperville, albeit the wrong high school, but one of the great state champions in Illinois high school history.
From Chicago, yeah. Obviously.
Look, you share facilities, but what is the what meaning does it have this hire for you, and how does that reciprocate?
Yeah, well, first off, Evan's dear friend and just a great person, and so I think there's a comfort in coming to work every day and knowing the person next to you is just genuine, cares, and felt like Evan and I could talk about anything anytime we wanted to. So going to miss him a lot. Yeah. and miss that camaraderie with him. Elizabeth, haven't spent a ton of time with her, but the little bit of time that I have so far, ton of energy, looks like she's ready to work her tail off and kind of go nonstop. And that's been her reputation a little bit from talking to the coaches at UCLA and so forth, is she's going to give everything she's got. She's going to go for it. She's going to do it. I think just integrity is a word that, that sort of follows her around everywhere. So she's going to do it the right way and not try to cut corners. But from a work ethic standpoint, I think she's going to be up there at the top. And so that'll be good. Keep us on our toes.
Do you like the change in the tennis calendar to do individual in the fall? And I mean, it used to be that, you know, team in May and then a few weeks later, individual championships. Do you like that, moving that?
I think long term, it's the right move for us. I think you've got some old fogies like me a little bit that still reminisce, you know, when Bob Bryan gets a triple crown, you know, when he wins the team and the singles and the doubles, and there's a little bit of magic to that 2 week period where you go all the way through the team and then all the way through the singles and doubles. And so I think I'll always have a little bit of that nostalgia. But when you think about the health of the game and how it can grow best, I think trying to spotlight the team championships at the end of the year is maybe the best way to do that long term. And then also trying to spotlight those individuals in the fall. And so I think when we first started talking about that as a pilot, there was the sense that we were going to get a little bit stronger media coverage, particularly in the fall, than what we've had. So if we can maybe get that on the Tennis Channel, that's a strong selling point for our sport.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Golf Channel has done that with
exactly,
you know, getting the individual out there and pushing that. And I'm sure that's a thing. It's just interesting to me, again, as someone, my dad subscribe to Tennis Magazine and everything else. So I my first exposure to sports statistics was in tennis. Is it something that can be, you know, going back to our discussion of getting some of these European guys like De Bruyne over here to play? You think that's is a path for the growth of college tennis? Is to, hey, now there's a little higher level of player and the names you're going to hear in the Grand Slams in a few years might be playing here instead of going there. Is that a path for growth for college tennis?
It, you know, again, I feel like I was overseeing the board, not the board, but the coaches committee for a number of years. And we really just have not been able to grow eyeballs on tennis overall. And that's been really frustrating for me, kind of being a little bit of a leadership role in this. But, you know, I'm so happy and so pleased for sports like volleyball, where you just see the numbers keep ticking up, right? Their attendance at their Final Four national championship, their TV viewership for those types of, yeah, I think it's up to 2 million or something like that. And tennis is not there right now. So we talk a lot about our format, our product, how to get it more accessible, how to get it more fan-friendly. And that's probably, to me, our biggest challenge in terms of growing. Like, we've always, and Jimmy Connors played college tennis, John McEnroe played college tennis, so we've had great players before. How do we get this where there's more people in the stands? How do we get it where it's more fan friendly to engage in on TV? And right now we haven't solved that crisis.
Yeah, because golf has done that of saying, like, hey, John Rahm is playing at Arizona State and he's the future, and tune into these NCAA championships because you're gonna see Victor Hovland win for Oklahoma State and then, you know, go do something in a major someday and that type of thing. So, yeah.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, when they made that switch, I think the Golf Channel came to the coaches and said, you need to go to match play to do that. That's, and the exactly coaches, right, I think, were really reluctant, like we always are, you know, and say, oh, we don't want to do that. You know, it ruins the integrity of this sport or whatever else. And and look what it's done for golf. So I think tennis is in a similar space where we need to be thinking outside the box. What can we do that's, I don't want to say made for TV, that sounds wrong, but just more conducive to TV and try to help keep growing the sport.
Sure. Well, I do applaud the efforts that you made. I paid more attention, but I just noticed the efforts that were made to get fans in this year. I don't know if it paid off in the numbers, but it seemed like there was some real energy around Illinois men's tennis this year, and you guys made a great run in part, but there was some real, you know, the vibe inside Atkins was great, or outside if you were playing outside.
Yeah, I think we did this last summer of 2025, we kind of did a big analysis of what's worked and what's not worked. Yeah. and then we really tried to stick to a script every match this year. So
yeah, and because we get our audience has asked us before, like, hey, we know we get football, we get coming to basketball games, we want to know what else. When you come to Illinois, what do you want to go see? Where do you want to, you know, and a tennis match is a lot of fun, and there's a lot of energy in that. It's not a quiet please. Yeah. You know, it's kind of raucous.
I think it's people always, oh, what do you mean by that? And then they come out and come to a tennis match and like, oh my gosh, that was really invigorating, right? Yeah. That was energetic, that was loud, that was intense. Like that was not at all. And then obviously the athleticism that the players are demonstrating. You know, you got guys, I think it's hard for a lot of people to think about, but they're sliding around on a hard court, right? And you can hear their shoes squeaking, you know, on a surface that a lot of people aren't expecting to see.
And if we did a top moments of the decade or something like that, the day where you won, so Illini Golf came back from 8 strokes down to beat Iowa, and then like 11 minutes later, was it 4-3? It was 3-3, and the last set was in a tiebreaker or something like that. Do you remember how that ended? I'm just saying, like, tennis and golf had a moment right there of, like, you know, wow, these are exciting sports that golf can, you know, and that's now broadcast live, the Big Ten Championships. And then 11 minutes later, was it in Nebraska that year? You guys.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
You guys won title 4-3 over Ohio State in the final of the
stinking thing. Ohio State.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That draw this year, that's a whole other subject. To have to go to Ohio State in the Sweet 16, that's just stupid. I get how it works, but that was...
He's going to remain
tight. I
hated
that for you.
You're going to remain tight-lipped on that one.
I'll say all the words, but having to... You know, you could draw anybody of a top seed, and to draw Ohio State in the Sweet 16 is just stupid. Anyway, but yes, there are moments where the fan base, I can sense from my end of it, really comes alive for these other sports of like, wow, this is, you know... This is something, and Illinois has had this tennis program. I mean, the following in 03, even 07, 07 was the other final.
Went to the final, 07, yeah.
07, 07 final. You know, even online at the time of people following, and, you know, that there's the ability to watch now. You can just pull up a camera and watch it. I've always said that, like, it's primed for more, you know, have more moments like that, and you're going to get more eyeballs. So. Yeah.
All right, before I let you go, we here at Light the Eye pride ourselves on the ground reporting that we do. Producer Kendall back here has a summer job involved with sports drinks. So he has embedded himself with the various camps going on around here and reports that apparently you're not afraid to do some singing into the microphone with the young people and that you did a pretty good Rihanna.
Breaking news here. My goodness.
This is with the young kids?
They got a little taste of old school Coach Dancer out there over the last few weeks at camp. So, yeah, we used to run...
This is the summer camps that you run, right?
We run 2 weeks worth of summer camps. Yeah. And yeah. We have a good time. It's a great opportunity. We raise some funds for assistant coaches and for the program and so forth out of that. But it's also a time to coach and make it really just purely about the fun and the enjoyment of the game, you know, and you take we coach the kids well, we coach them hard and so forth, but yeah, there might be some singing and dancing that gets involved in that and attempted moonwalks and so forth.
Kendall, I know you're going to have some tennis coming up in Cincinnati in August. Do you have any questions for Coach about, you know, what to do while there?
I think I just need some singing lessons, honestly.
Said no one ever to me.
Forehand, backhand, yeah, and singing. Exactly. Could you please help me, Brad Dancer?
That's right.
Congratulations on a great 21st season as a head coach. Here's to a great 22nd, and we hope you can come back and visit us again on Light the Eye.
I love it. Thanks for having me on. Love the concept of light in the eye, and let's keep lighting it as much as we can.
Okay, you got it. Thanks, Coach.
Enjoyable conversation with Brad Dancer. You know, you talked about your high school tennis career.
Yes.
Well, I went to high school in the suburbs.
Okay.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned that I'm from Naperville.
I think a couple times, including earlier.
Yes. The Naperville North Huskies won the state championship the year I was in eighth grade. And so I was afforded the luxury of being at a high school where I took tennis lessons, mm-hmm, and my freshman year tried out for the tennis team and got cut.
Mm.
So I didn't play any high school tennis because, mm-hmm, my high school was too good.
Yes.
For people like me.
And I want to emphasize, had I played at any of these high schools, I too would have been cut. However, down in Southern Illinois, I looked up, I have this, I found it in a box recently. If I edit this episode, I'm going to put it on the screen right now. We got like plaques at the end of our tennis career. And so like, it, you know, like the spring sports banquet kind of thing. I have this plaque and I still have it. And I have a photo of it, of all my tennis accomplishments. My career individual record, I played 50 individual matches. What do you think my career record was?
In high school.
In high school.
7-43.
Give me a little credit. I'll show it to you right now.
You set it up, you know.
I was 40-10.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay, I thought you were setting me up for this. Like, no. I only made the tennis team because I had a pulse.
I'm going to scale this for you, okay? I was okay, all right? The kids at Wood River High School, the kids at Bethalto Civic Memorial, the kids playing for Vandalia when we would play a non-conference match were very, very bad at tennis. Therefore, on this like lowered level, I'm winning a lot of those matches, even though I'm terrible. So
you were in the terrible beating even more terrible.
Yes. Yes. I was, picture it like a golf tournament that has like A flight, B flight, and C flight, just to give awards for the bad teams. I was down on C flight winning awards.
Okay, well, I'm here to tell you if I had a career individual record, it would have been similar to 7-43.
Yes. I could play doubles, right? I could serve and I could volley. The whole ground strokes thing, the whole get in a rally, I was known to make a few unforced errors.
Since people tune into this pod to hear our takes on tennis.
And hear my individual record for...
Do you still follow it?
I do.
Here's my question. Mm-hmm. So you follow it to a degree.
Yes.
On the men's side,
mm-hmm.
who's the best player in the world right now?
Alcaraz or Sinner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just me, or is there not like this star gravitas of the Nadals, the Federers, yes. the
We just
Djokovic's.
Went through a phase because it was three guys dominant for a decade plus. Because of that, we're in this like, okay, well, who's the next Jordan kind of a moment where we're not really sure who it is.
Yeah.
But it's just those two guys. You know,
I feel similar in women, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm just waiting for another U.S. player. Was the last, like, Roddick in 07 at the U.S. Open or something, is the last U.S. player to win a Grand Slam? Like, the women, they've been doing great, but the men, you just can't get a Grand Slam champion. And so... maybe it's Ben Shelton. Maybe he's the next guy. Somebody has to win. Somebody has to win one of these.
All right. We will be with you after the 4th of July, after the semi-sesquicentennial.
Yes.
The 250th
mm-hmm.
birthday of America. 250 years, but can't get a Grand Slam winner.
Can't win a tennis.
Did we fight for?
Can I tell a sesquicentennial story? Wait. No, not sesquicentennial. Sesquicentennial is 150.
Yeah, this What's is a 250? Semi-sesquicentennial.
Is that what it is?
I
really?
I believe so, yeah.
Interesting. Can I tell my sesquicentennial story anyway?
Do I have an option?
No, but people will love it. You ready?
Okay.
1987, my town, Highland, Illinois, where I grew up, turned 150, had a sesquicentennial celebration. My town is of Swiss heritage.
If it's Swiss and Swedish, then you're Swish.
No, yes. It is of Swiss heritage. The city hall in Highland has like the little fancy little woodwork at the top of the building. Looked like a Swiss chalet. And for some reason, my family thought it would be a great idea to go to the celebration dressed in lederhosen. I don't know why. I think because of some German background that we had. If you want to be popular in eighth grade, do you know what you don't do, Scott? Do you know what you avoid doing? Wearing lederhosen in public with your entire family. Yes. That's the end of my story. I was the kid walking around the sesquicentennial, just like, I'm going to die at school when it starts in the fall.
Thankfully, now you know how to, you've got much better drip, as the kids would say.
Yes. And all I do now is just wear Illini gear. That's it.
And from
stay
the,
in my lane.
And from the corrections department, I misspoke. A semi-sesquicentennial is your 175th.
Oh, okay.
America is celebrating its semi-quincentennial.
Semi-quincentennial, which is half of a five, so 250. Yeah. Got it.
There you go.
Got it.
Now you know.
Well, happy birthday, America. Kids, don't wear lederhosen.
For Amber Waves of Grain. Thanks to Kendall Crawford, our producer. Thanks to our guest, Brad Dancer. For Robert Rosenthal, I'm Scott Beatty. We'll talk to you again the next time we light the eye.